It's Thursday, May the 9th, 2024, and welcome back to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the globe. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Distinguished Policy Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution, and I'm not the only Hoover Fellow who's podcasting these days. In fact, I suggest you go to our website, which is hoover.org, click on the tab at the top of the homepage that says Commentary, then head over to where it says Multimedia, and up will pop our podcasts. There are over a dozen in all, including this one. Now, this is the California version of Matters in Policy and Politics that we do once a month. Ordinarily, Jonathan Morvrotis will be doing the moderating, but Jonathan's not with us today, so I've got the microphone, which may or may not be good news for our guest today, which is, of course, my sidekick in all things California, Leo Hanian. Leo is a senior fellow adjunct here at the Hoover Institution and a professor of economics and director of the Edinger Family Program in macroeconomic research at UCLA. As I mentioned, he's also my partner in California endeavors, most importantly, California On Your Mind, which is a Hoover Institution web channel devoted to all things California. Lee and I writing each week on various aspects of the California existence. Lee, great to see you.
Hey, Bill. Good to see you.
A lot to unpack here in the fifth month of the year, but let's start with the big news in California for the past week or so, which is pro-Palestinian protest on California campuses statewide, north, south, east, and west. We're talking USC and UCLA up here in the Bay Area where I am, Lee, Cal Berkeley and Stanford, Cal Poly Humboldt had to shut down at one point. I'd like to focus on UCLA because, first of all, you wrote an excellent column in California On Your Mind on it. But also, Lee, for you, this is very personal. I think you mentioned in your lead in your column that you've taught at UCLA. You've taught economics for the past 25 years, so you obviously care very much. So tell us why UCLA handled this wrong, why it was not about free speech and what could have been avoided.
Yes, Bill, I've been at UCLA for 25 years. And in that time, I've taught about 7,000 undergrad students and 500 to 600 PhD students. I've never seen anything like what occurred at UCLA last week, in which a few hundred pro-Palestinian protesters took over an area called Royce Quadrangle. Royce Quadrangle was named after Royce Hall, which I'm guessing everyone at some point or another, whether in a movie or a television show, some type of video, has seen Royce Hall. It's a large, very interesting artisan design building that's UCLA's most iconic. And then there's a grassy area in front of that. And right across from that is the undergraduate library. So it's a very, very active part of campus. And that part of campus was taken over by pro-Palestinian protesters on Thursday, April 25th. It was forcibly cleared out by law enforcement about a week later. But in that time, the university, in my opinion, just completely mismanaged what had happened. And in some cases, just egregiously so. And in some cases, just almost without any common sense. So I'll give you a few examples. Mm-hmm. On Sunday, which would have been now, it's about a week and a half ago, there was a Jewish girl who was beaten unconscious. She was carrying a flag of Israel. She dropped the flag and she was kicked in the head to the point where she was unconscious and she was taken to the emergency room. That was on Sunday, April 28th. The next day, which was the first day of the week for the academic week, there was Jewish students were trying to walk through the area and protesters were preventing them from walking. And there's a YouTube video that's linked in my column that shows this. His friends were videoing this encounter. I was not there at that time. I was around that area at other points of the day, and campus security was simply allowing protesters to prevent students from walking across campus. And of course, this is completely unacceptable. That was the day after a girl was beaten unconscious. On the same day, that Monday, April 29th, there was a Jewish professor. He has been at UCLA almost as long as I am, 22 years. He was tackled. He was tackled by protesters. I think it's fine. But you look at three of these types of incidents, I'm sure there are more that I'm simply not aware of. Every day I was receiving emails from campus leadership telling me that the protest is mostly peaceful and we, UCLA's leadership, are doing everything we can to to allow our Bruins to freely express themselves and not disrupt campus operations. Well, campus operations were incredibly disrupted. The undergraduate library, one of the busiest buildings on campus, access was restricted. Royce Hall, access was restricted. Individuals who apparently were Jewish were not allowed to walk through that area. So at some level, Bill, what does it mean? What does it mean not to disrupt campus operations? And then finally, roughly a week after the encampment started, the UCLA's leadership decided to clear the encampment, and they brought in Highway Patrol and riot gear to clear the encampment. About 200 people were taken into custody, released later. 300 left of their own decision to leave. So UCLA is home to about 77,000, is a community of 77,000 people, 46,000 students, 31,000 faculty and people working there. So roughly 500 individuals took over and completely disrupted campus life involving 77,000. It's about 0.4%. And that simply should have never been allowed to happen. And people were physically assaulted. That should never have been allowed to happen. And then Bill, to make matters worse, after all this took place, after the campus was after that encampment was cleared, I received an email indicating from campus leadership, "We are perplexed. We're perplexed how this could have happened with a mostly peaceful, with a mostly peaceful protest." And I'm just shaking my head thinking, you may as well given the car keys to the family car to a 12-year-old, said, "Hey, go out and have a good time." And when they come home from joyriding and the car is cracked up, being, "Hey, how could that happen? How could the family car get cracked up being driven on a joyride by a 12-year-old?" I mean, I find that to be equivalent.
You know, Lee, I'm shocked, Lee, when I saw the phrase mostly peaceful, and here's why. Let's go back to the summer of 2000. You probably remember that CNN reporter standing in Kenosha, Wisconsin, while a building behind him was just, a five-alarm fire. And one of the screen captions say below him, "Fiery but mostly peaceful protests." And so I just think the phrase mostly peaceful will get retired. But I'm curious, as a member of the faculty, Lee, what guidance, if any, do you get as an economics professor in terms of what role you could play in the protest? Is anybody putting out any guidelines saying don't do this, or if you do do this, what's the limits? Or is just every professor free to do what he or she so chooses?
Well, there is, in my opinion, there is a remarkable lack of leadership. And that certainly comes across when you look at the timeline of what occurred at UCLA
Right.
and the failure to take decisions that was in the really in the best interest of everyone. We were getting emails coming back and forth saying, "Oh, hold all your classes on Zoom." And then the next day, "Oh, the encampment's been cleared. You can go back to holding your classes in person." And then just this past Monday, so today is Thursday, so just on Monday, May 6th, I was under the impression my classes were to be held in person. On Monday morning, I was busy. I had meetings and seminars. The entire morning, I didn't check email. I went to my 1 o'clock class,
Oh,
which is 25 kids and 20 to 25 kids. Only three kids were there. And I looked at them, I said, "Man, what happened?" They said, "Oh, you didn't get the email?" An email came in this morning saying, "All classes are shifted back to Zoom." Now, Bill, this is roughly, I don't know, 16 hours after I was told all classes are to be held in person. So I missed the email that came in because I was busy. So there's really just it strikes me as a rudderless, really as a rudderless ship. What perhaps was just the saddest thing is that there are some faculty on campus who were suggesting the idea that classes be moved to the protest site, and that whatever class one was teaching, weave in the issues regarding Gaza and Palestinian Arabs and Jews and Israel. And I just thought, oh my God, is there not an adult around here? I mean, you're going to put students in danger and you're going to open up the university to just an enormous potential liability issue. So there really was just, I think, a gross lack of leadership in my opinion as to what took place.
So
And it
what
really,
should the leadership have done differently, Lee?
yeah. So really, it boils down to just having a simple set of principles, which is universities are places where people have different opinions, and universities simply cannot take a stand on political or cultural or social issues unless there's something directly impacting the mission of the university. And in my opinion, I think most people's opinion, the Gaza war does not directly impact the main mission of UCLA or the University of California. And in those circumstances, you got to protect people on campus. When it comes to free expression, freedom of speech, you vigorously protect that. But this protest was never about freedom of speech. It was about taking over part of the university and staying there indefinitely because the protesters wanted UCLA and the UC system more broadly to divest from investments that were related with Israel and not do business with organizations that have ties to Israel. That was the purpose of this. This was not about peacefully carrying signs or respectfully saying we stand in solidarity with the Palestinians and we want the Gaza war to end. It was never about that. It was about taking over the university, and that should not be tolerated. So what the university could have done is simply to say, if you want to have a protest, okay, you coordinate it with us. We'll give you a start time. We'll give you an end time. We'll give you a specific area where you can take into your protest. We will have campus security there to protect you, to protect everyone. And you cannot disrupt the mission of the university. You can't block people from walking across the line. You cannot stop people from walking into a classroom. That simply is not tolerated. And if that happens, the protests will be disbanded. You can't camp out overnight. You follow these parameters, which are in place for your safety and the safety of everyone, and then we're good to go. But that's as far as it can go. And UCLA simply allowed a very small group of people relative to the size of the community to take over a spot to build these makeshift barriers where just horrible things were spray painted on there about Jews. And the university let this happen. And so you, at the end of the day, you just ask yourself, why? Why did they do this? Why did they make what appears now just to be an obvious blunder? And so now there's a move within the university to possibly have a vote of no confidence in UCLA's chancellor, who has only a few weeks left. He announced his resignation several months ago. He will return to the as a normal faculty member on July 1st of this year. But it goes deeper than that. It goes within the leadership of UCLA. There's just a common sense aspect to stuff that was not followed, and now we're paying the price for it.
And then finally, Lee, what's going to happen? Let's look at the calendar. So UCLA's commencement is not until June. So I'm curious as to what you think is going to happen then. And then the new school year will start, what, August, early September? And I'm curious about that. And here's why. Commencement brings in alumni, brings in donors. The new school year brings in parents. This is ultimately money for the school. And I hate to be crass, but when you look at situations like Columbia, you can't tell me that they were motivated in large part by the fact that their commencement was breathing right down their neck. So, is UCLA going to be ready to handle a commencement? Will it be ready to open its doors next fall?
Yeah, I hope so. A new chancellor has not been announced yet. So what will happen as far as commencement goes, keep my fingers crossed. But I think right now it's just fundamental. I think the university just has to say, we are not going to permit any type of occupation of university property. That will be cleared out. And once that's communicated, Bill, one thing you heard protesters saying is that we were shocked when police and riot gear arrived. We never had any idea about this. The university never gave us a heads up about this. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But clear expectations have to be in place that you simply can't do this. You can't take over property like this. That's not permissible. And if that's a clear expectation, then and only that only the university will permit freedom of speech. Yeah, you can carry a sign, you can say free Gaza, you can say those kinds of things, but we're not going to let you take over property. And once that's understood, I think you'll see a lot less of this, because if protesters understand that they're not going to be able to do what they really want to do, then they're not going to do it. I don't think they really want to go to jail. So if that change of rules takes place, then I think we should be fine for commencement. But if it doesn't, then I don't know.
So I wrote a California Remind piece last week, Lee, also on the campus protest. But I went back and I looked at history, and I looked at the 1960s and the effect that protest had on state politics. And people tend to forget that actually 1964 was the beginning of the Vietnam movement in California schools, Berkeley that fall, having protest over free speech, mushroomed in 1965 and paved the way for one Ronald Reagan to be elected governor in 1966. And this was Reagan's brand. He ran against the Berkeley protest for governor, basically a theme of, the inmates are running the asylum. And when he was governor, he took these hands on. He was just very, he had a showdown with students on the campus. He didn't shy away from it. And he contrasts that to what Gavin Newsom's approach has been here. And Newsom's approach is interesting, Lee, because here's a guy who clearly rarely misses a chance to be in front of the cameras, to make news, to see his face on TV. And he, like the president's, kept a very low profile here. He put out a somewhat wishy-washy statement about protests not leading to violence, everybody getting along. He did send in the CHP and UCLA when requested. But it's interesting, two things that Newsom could be doing here, Lee, which he will not do. Number one, he could ask for a real deep dive into the operations of the UC and CSU systems and look into campus culture. And what I'd be particularly interested in, Lee, is the hiring and coddling of professors who are just clearly anti-Semitic or in any ways are supporting Hamas, Hezbollah, jihadism in general. So if I were the governor, I'd want to know, how did our schools get to be this way? Why do we have these people teaching, on the public's dime? The second thing that stands out, Lee, is, since he's in California, if there's nothing stopping Gavin Newsom from going down to the Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles and giving a very strong speech, as the president did the other day, denouncing anti-Semitism. But when you look at past Newsom statements, he, like other Democrats, are trying to put anti-Semitism up against Islamophobia. He's just trying to walk a careful line. What it reminds me of is this, Lee. In 1992, Bill Clinton had a problem. It became evident that he had a did his best to avoid the draft. He was not lucky and drew a high number. He pulled strings and he wrote a letter to the ROTC director at the University of Arkansas at the time, Lee, with this long agonizing ramble as to why he decided to just kind of play the system. And the famous phrase that he used, Lee, was, he did what he did to, quote, maintain my political viability within the system. And you look at Gavin Newsom right now, Lee, and that's what Newsom is doing. He's trying to maintain his political viability with an eye on 2028, because you see with the president right now, who seems just absolutely paralyzed by the fear of alienating young voters over Hamas, Newsom just is not as forceful as you might think a California governor would be in this instance.
No, Bill, and I don't know if you saw this LA Times article about the protests in Newsom. They did an interview with a woman, Sherry Bebich Jeffy, who is a longtime, very deep within the Democratic Party political analyst. She's been around at least 40 years, and she's part of the USC Communications department. And the very end of the LA Times article quoted her. I'm not going to get it exactly right, but it was to the effect of something like, "Gavin Newsom simply has decided not to be part of the battlefield of protest because it's not in his political interests."
Right.
So that really spoke volumes in terms of leadership, in terms of taking a strong stand, and being a person who is going to say, "Look, here's what's tolerated, here's what's not tolerated, and what's not tolerated is because people get hurt, and because we prevent kids from going to college." And Bill, I can't tell you how many parents and students are just so upset about what happened. I mean, their education is getting disrupted, and we know that Zoom classes, remote videoing, is just simply not nearly as effective as in classroom instruction. And they are really upset, and rightly so. And I think there really is a vacuum right now within the state about taking a strong stand and trying to get a better outcome. Bill, another thing I wrote about in that column is, I had an opportunity to chat with one protester. Now it's just one protester. But one thing that this brings to mind is that your people have very, very strong opinions about this issue about Gaza and Israel and Palestinian Arabs and the war and Hamas. But the person I spoke with, their view was very simplistic. It was Israel's the enemy. They're engaging in genocide. They are baby killers. And I kind of probed him a little bit, and I said, do you know that they were living there nearly 2,000 years before Islam was even a religion? And he didn't know that because he wanted to call Israel colonizers and land stealers. And my point was, they were there 2,000 years, 2 millennia before Islam was even around. I said they were kicked out. They were kicked out by the Romans and by the Ottoman Empire. Completely silent. He had no idea about this. He also was of the opinion that he didn't know that in 1947, Arabs had turned down the UN offer of a two-state solution because Arabs did not want Jews to have any land whatsoever in that area. He had no idea about any of this. And finally, I asked him, do you think the Gazans, do you think their best interests are represented by Hamas, a political organization that's dedicated to destroying Israel? And how do you, if you're in a war with Hamas, what do you do? What do you do when they want to surrender? What do you do when they're never going to renounce? Say, I want to destroy you. Yep, had no idea. Just Israel's the enemy, and they've got to be stopped. And that was it. So there's just a remarkable lack of understanding, and it's a complex, incredibly messy issue. But it was Bill, it was depressing to see how little, at least for this one person, how little they understood about about an issue that they felt so strongly about.
And finally, Lee, let's delve a little bit into the economics of the protests. In this regard, the protesters, one of their announced goals is they want California universities to divest from Israel. And there's precedent. Colleges have divested from Iran and Sudan in the past. So I guess the next shoe to drop is that some lawmaker will introduce a bill to have California divest from Israel. This would be a symbolic gesture, Lee, because you cannot do this as a state without permission from the federal government. So I don't think Washington's going to come forward with that. But the reality is that California and Israel are rather entwined when it comes to economics. I've looked up some data from the California Chamber of Commerce. It says that Israel is California's 18th largest source of foreign direct investment. Israeli foreign-owned enterprises account for 6,743 jobs and about $807 million in wages. If you're a protester, Lee, you might have to change your own lifestyle. For example, do you need to get off Google? Why Google? Google provides cloud computing services to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. So, do you see this divestment idea going anywhere?
I don't. It's completely impractical. I was surprised to see UC Riverside agree to protester demands. Now, they, of course, as you noted, you can't say, I'm not going to invest in Israeli related businesses or index funds. But they said, we're not going to invest in organizations or countries that are engaged in genocide and crimes against humanity and this type of thing. And of course, that raises the question, well, what's the definition of genocide? What are the definitions of crimes against humanity? I suspect that probably will just kind of dry up and blow away. But again, I think it illustrates that people who are protesting this and who want things like divestment, they haven't really thought this through. They don't understand how difficult this would be. And they don't understand that it would not necessarily be in the best interest of people who are in Gaza. And Bill, there's the idea of Hamas surrendering, simply just unconditionally surrendering, releasing hostages. Who knows? I mean, hopefully they're still alive. We just have no idea. And renouncing their goal of destroying Israel and simply saying, you know what? Okay, let's try to have, we support a permanent peace. There was no I said, don't. I asked this fellow, don't you think a lot of bloodshed could have been avoided? Yeah, hadn't thought about that either. And what's sad, Bill, is that there's UCLA is incredibly difficult to get into as a first year student. Yeah,
Yes.
acceptance rate is something like 5 or 6%. And Bill, what I thought was, there's some really, really bright kids out there who could have taken up this slot here at UCLA, who could have really, gone on and do some great things with their lives. And maybe this fellow will, but The but I don't have high hopes for that. Let's put it that way.
That'll be the interesting thing to look at, Lee. If this does flare up again in June, if it does come back again in September in the fall, does this have an impact on UCLA applications? People wanting to get in there. Harvard had a 5% drop in its applications, for example. So we'll see if UCLA has it. The other thing, Lee, is if you were a protester and you get kicked out of the school and you don't have a home, you're now homeless in California. And let's talk about homelessness for a minute. I want to draw your attention, Lee, to this week's Assembly Budget Subcommittee on Oversight and Accountability hearing, during which lawmakers asked the Newsom administration to produce data to prove that California's homelessness housing and assistance program is working. Lee, no such data was available. This after state audit found California's Interagency Council on Homelessness isn't tracking spending outcomes. And Lee had had this wonderful exchange between Phil Ting, who's an assemblyman from San Francisco, and a poor Newsom official put on the chopping block, and it went something like this. Ting said, quote, "You're coming to the hearing today. We've spent billions of dollars. And you can't tell us at all how many people we've helped." Poor official said that she's looking into quote unquote data quality issues and trying to establish a quote user-friendly data system. When? Ting asked, and she said in a few short weeks. Ting said, before we vote on a budget, she said, "I can't say within a definite date," to which he said, "How do you expect us to vote on something without any data?" Now, I would caution Lee that that's not the first time that's happened in Sacramento. It happens every year when they vote on something that, where there's not data, they don't know what they're voting on. But it does raise a problem here with homelessness in California's approach, Lee. You look at Operation Room Key, for example, which has succeeded in part in getting homeless people into hotel rooms and lowering the risk of COVID. However, researchers are unable to cross-reference death records, so you can't really determine if Room Key saved lives to keep people healthier. So, Lee, how do we get in this situation where we have billions upon billions of dollars thrown at the problem, but we don't know if the billions upon billions of dollars are working?
No, Bill, there's, you know, we've talked several times over the past years, and since we started writing our California on Your Mind column, which we're coming up on our sixth anniversary, we've talked a lot about the lack of accountability within state government, the lack of incentives throughout the system for people to do their job, and for people within state government workers to be at all entrepreneurial and saying, "Hey, I got a good idea. Let's track homelessness spending. Let's figure out what's working. Let's figure out what's not working." How can that possibly come to pass, Bill? Well, the answer is that there's simply no accountability within state government. For the most part, there's no incentives among those who are working these agencies to advance those ideas. And so we wind up with that hearing that was called by Joshua Hoover. He's assemblyman, I think near Sacramento, somewhere near Sacramento. And Bill, you know, he has championed this. I believe he's been in office only about a year or so. He's part of the Republican caucus. And Republicans, Bill, for years have been trying to get this audit conducted. And for years they were stymied until they could get some bipartisan support from Democrats. And the bipartisan support came from Democrats because Democrats were hearing from their constituents, what's going on? Why are we having to deal with so much homelessness, so much drug abuse, so much drop in the quality of life within our communities? So that's the only reason this audit got traction. And of course, now we kind of see what has happened. Nobody knows where the money's going. Nobody knows what's working. So, Bill, we've spent about $25 billion. And I think I'm in a California On Your Mind column a couple months ago. I made a calculation where I simply divided how much we'd spent on homelessness under Newsom as governor. I divided that, you know, that's $20 to $25 billion, depending upon how you count some stuff. And I divided it by the number of homeless when Newsom took office, and it comes out to something like $200,000 per homeless person. And what has happened is that homelessness, of course, has increased substantially since Newsom's been in office. And in my opinion, a big reason about that is because we're just burning money. We're
So,
simply just burning money
what it
on
does,
this
Lee, is
issue.
it makes California an easy target for ridicule. And I turn your attention now to a column in the Kansas City Star where somebody kind of thinks along the lines of what you do. And here's what the columnist wrote, and I'll read it to you. Quote, Every time a nutty story pops up about the Golden State, you think it must be the nuttiest, but you're wrong. Whether it's spritzes, potties, or houses, Governor Gavin Newsom's woke wonderland is spending money on the homeless like, well, water. And the column goes on, quote, in some places, one unit of supportive housing for people who are homeless costs a cool $1 million. And every month after it is built, taxpayers fork over $17,000 for security, maintenance, social workers to help them get government assistance, utilities, cleaning, and such. To put that in perspective for people in normal America, you could buy each Californian suffering from homelessness two first-class tickets to Kansas City or National Airport, get them a limo ride to their new home, which would be a new three-bedroom ranch, fully furnished with a new Tesla in the garage, and still save hundreds of thousands of dollars. Every month you could give them a salary for picking up cans and other debris along the highways. That would be greater than half of what working Missourians make and still save $10,000 off that monthly bill. Boom.
Yeah, 100% right. 100% right. But this is the reason why homelessness is, as I've argued for the last 6 years, I don't like being right about this, but as I've argued for the last 6 years, it'll never get resolved. And it's, you know, I didn't think it was going to get all that much worse, but it has, and it's going to be just an enormous fiscal drain on the state. And I suspect it's going to just get worse, Bill. One reason being that California has become just even more expensive to live in. And we simply haven't been willing to accept the fact that homelessness has an awful lot to do with substance abuse, mental health issues. And that's really politically incorrect to talk about. It's much more politically correct to say, oh, you know, these people, they can't afford to live here. There's a lot of homeless housing and capacity, certainly in San Francisco, that sits vacant every day. Because this is not simply about putting a roof over people's heads and everything will be fine. That's not the issue. And the state's still not willing to accept that. There was like a little bit of movement about that regarding Prop 1, which passed, what was it, 50.3 to 49.8, something like that.
Right.
And
the fact that it barely passed when there was no opposition to it and there was, you know, just nothing on the ballot, it was vaguely Republican to draw out the conservatives. It barely passed, Lee, because the public is having this issue with spending money, not getting results.
Yeah. And they should.
Okay. Well, Lee, the situation calls for somebody who's politically non-correct, a strong man, if you will. And we know he's a strong man because he likes to work out with his shirt off. That takes us to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is now on the ballot in California this November. Kennedy running as a third-party candidate. He is actually repping the American Independent Party in California. Our eagle-eyed political students will understand the irony here. It was in 1968 that George Wallace, the famous segregationist who was a nemesis of the Kennedy administration in the early 60s, he also was an independent American Independent candidate, though it's now rebranded Independent Party, if you will. So this is my topic for this week's California On Your Mind column, Lee, and it's the question of a couple of things. Number one, is Kennedy really at play in California? I think the answer, Lee, is a decided no. He gets about 10% in polls right now, even if he reached what I call peak Perot, which was Perot running as this wild card in 1992. Perot only got 20% in California, so didn't change things. What I found more interesting, though, Lee, was how the younger Kennedy connects to California compared to the older. And if you go back to 68, it was on an airplane ride from the Central Valley back to Los Angeles that Bobby Kennedy first told his aides he's going to run for president. And then he announces, and a week later, he's back in San Jose, and he gives a very heartfelt speech in which he's tapping into disillusionment with Vietnam, and he's tapping into the plight of migrant workers in the Central Valley in the ag industry, his friendship with Cesar Chavez. It's obvious that California is very much front and center on his mind when it comes to campaigning. You fast forward to 2024, Lee, though, and you look at RFK Jr., and here's the essence of Kennedy's campaign. I'll read it to you, Lee, and I want you to tell me how California is centric to this. This is what Kennedy said when he announced in Philadelphia last year, quote, we declare independence from the corporations that have hijacked our government, and we declare independence from the Wall Street, from big tech, from big pharma, from big ag, from the military contractors and the lobbyists. Is that really a California message, Lee?
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of quarters it's not. Big tech, A lot of support for the Democratic Party coming from big tech. Big pharma, they support both sides. There's a populist tinge to that bill that I think is resonating with a lot of young people. And I haven't tracked his numbers recently, but is most of the support coming from younger people?
It's coming from younger, and the concern is actually right now. So it pivots back and forth. So until about a month ago, the concern was that he was taking away votes from Joe Biden based on the last name, Democratic familiarity. But now the concern among Republicans is he's taking votes away from Trump. Why? It's because he's very much anti-vaccine. He's a conspiracy guy. He just don't trust institutions, and that, of course, is heart and soul of MAGA. So the thinking right now is he takes more from Trump than he does from Kennedy. Excuse me, for Biden.
Interesting, interesting. He does have that pro-conspiracy aspect to it, and that goes a little bit across both ways. But no, I can see the connection with Trump and how that might be worrisome on the Republican side that he could be taking votes away. How is he doing in do you have a sense of how he's doing in swing states?
It's just peeling off this consistent 10 to 12% in swing states. And again, the question is, who are these people? Are they going to Trump? But the November election is just a complete riddle and a complete jump ball right now, because why? It's a turnout model, plain and simple. We don't know how Trump voters are going to turn out compared to the past two elections. We don't know if Biden can put together the same coalition he did in 2020. And there's a very small sliver of disaffected voters who are going to have to hold their nose and vote for one of those two, and they can't decide which. And so, good luck guessing. One thing I do know, though, Lee, is that RFK Jr. does not really understand California that well in this regard. Right after he made news by getting on the California ballot, his campaign put out a dare, and they called it the spoiler challenge to the Biden campaign. And the spoiler challenge is this: RFK Jr. wants Biden to agree to the two of them doing head-to-head polls with Donald Trump in mid-October. And whoever does worse than those head-to-head polls, Lee, agrees to drop out of the race. Well, that's a very interesting idea, and the media had fun reporting it. But there's one problem, Lee, is, being a Californian, by mid-October, you already have your ballot in possession. So if RFK Jr. wanted to do this, he'd have to do it around Labor Day just to keep Biden name off the ballot.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Bill, he's I guess what he's sort of considered a gadfly now, maybe on both sides. Biden seems to be completely ignoring him. Bill, at one point I had seen, I don't know if it was coming from RFK's camp or whether he said it personally, but I saw a couple of stories about him being mentioned as possible VP for Trump. I'm assuming that either would had no coherence, and by now it certainly doesn't. But
Well,
do you recall? Do you
assuming he hasn't killed any puppies, he has a leg up on at least one of the contenders for that job.
recall? Oh my God, what a what a gaffe that was.
That was beyond a gaffe. Yeah, he was floated as Donald Trump's running mate, but Trump keeps sending out just kind of signals that that's not going to happen. He's hinted that he wants somebody kind of in his own mold. He's hinted that he wants a woman. He's hinted that he wants somebody decidedly MAGA, and that's not Kennedy Junior at all. So don't think that's going to happen.
Bill, not so much in California, but do you see the possibility of any debate between Biden and Trump?
So that's a good question. So Biden went on Howard Stern's show a few days ago and said he's up for a debate, which was news to his camp. Trump is constantly trying to badger Biden into doing debates. He will continue to do so as the summer goes along. I think what will happen is this, Lee. I think there will be one debate. I think Biden's people will say, we're not going to share the stage with this nut for three in a row. Trump would probably want to do some version of Lincoln Douglas and just go all over the country with him. So I think they'll agree to one. And then the question is going to be, where does Bobby Kennedy fit into this? Because under current debate rules right now, 15% is the threshold for a third party candidate getting on that stage. But if he's at 10, 12, 13, 14% leads, could be awfully hard for these two to say, no, you can't come on because of the arbitrary 15. And so there's all kinds of schools of thought as how Kennedy would do on a debate stage, given he does have the problem with his voice. Would he really come across as that comforting to voters or not? So again, stay tuned. So, well, only got 6 more months of this to go, Lee, so hang in there. All right, Lee, I now want to turn your attention to something that keeps coming back on us like a bad meal, pun intended. And that is California's fast food minimum wage law. You wrote an excellent column on this about how the this is the new law that requires $20 an hour to if you're working at a large chain fast food operation in California. Your column, you say it's cost almost about 10,000 jobs already in California. My question, Lee, is why won't this story go away? I was watching my local news last night. You know what the lead was on local news last night, Lee?
I didn't see that.
It was a combination of two things. It was number one, how the minimum wage is hitting fast food operations in California, and then they segued into another law coming down the pike in Sacramento, probably another column for you, in which legislature is going after so-called junk fees in restaurants. These are just little add-ons that restaurants do to add on to your bill and just frankly make more money to survive, and they're now crying foul about that. The interesting angle in this, Lee, was they talked to the reporter talked to a couple of people who have gotten the $20 raise. And that's the good news, but here's the bad news, Lee. They're working fewer hours. Restaurants are now cutting back. Instead of working 40 hours a week, they talked to one interviewer who said that she went from $18.20 for 40 hours down to $20 for 35 hours. My crude math mill, Lee, if your math is better than mine, I calculate $18.20 at 40 hours to be $728 a week. 35 hours a week at $20 a week is $700. So she is now earning $28 less a week because of this higher wage. But why? So again, Lee, this just continues to be written up, even though it's been a long time since the given law. Why are we still stuck on this story?
Yeah, Bill, I'm glad the media is covering this because it is such a gross policy failure. Fast food industry, their employment the composition of the labor force is remarkably different than every other industry. So 60% of people working in fast food are 24 years old or less. In every other industry, 14% of the labor of their workers are 24 years or younger. So what this does is that we're suddenly jacking up the minimum wage to a level that's 25% higher than for every other industry in the state. And so why is that? Why single out fast food, particularly when they make so much use of really young people, when those young people tend to be, by definition, they have much less experience. They have far fewer skills. They need to be trained. They show up for work in June and then they're gone in August when they go back to school. These are restaurants that are earning 5 to 8% profit rates to begin with. So this is not like asking Sergey Brin at Google to say, oh, you know what, you can afford it. You can afford to write bigger paychecks for your workers. Help them. No, they really can't. And Bill, after this column came out, and so what I've estimated is nearly 10,000, close to 10,000 people lost their jobs in the industry after the legislation was signed by Newsom. And after that, after I wrote that piece, I spoke with a gentleman who owns a number of franchises in fast food within the state, and he told me that the rate of automation within fast food is going to accelerate. The rate at which they also use workers from outside of California is going to accelerate. In fact, I heard one story about a kiosk being manned by an individual who was living in Pakistan. A Pakistani person, very, very personable, very nice, spoke perfect English. They took the order. So this is really going to kill opportunities for young people. And I don't know. I grew up working these kinds of jobs. I mean, I worked in what would be called fast food, and it was the summertime. I think probably I started out a really bad employee, didn't know what I was doing. Then I learned how to work the cash register and learned what the tasks were. But it's not a high profit area. And this is really ends up just being a political payoff to the Service Employees International Union, which has spent over $100 billion over decades nationwide trying to unionize the fast food business. They couldn't get it done, so then they turned to legislators to try to do that. And so now we're seeing what happens, and there's a lot, awful lot of job loss that goes with this.
Yeah, Lee, I think the story resonates for two reasons. One, given people's obsessions with the price of everything, you may have not may or may not have noticed California fast food prices are up 7% in the last 6 months. So that Happy Meal is making you a lot less happy now in terms of its cost. So there's a tie into inflation economics. But secondly, this is also about the future of work. I was in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago, and I took my grandnephews into McDonald's. They are forever trying to sucker me into bets to get free lunches at McDonald's. So I play along with them. It's a fun little male bonding experience. We walked to McDonald's, and guess what, Lee? You walk up to a kiosk and you punch in your order, and then a couple of minutes later, somebody walks it out to you. That means there are at least two fewer jobs in that fast food place, two people who should be working behind the counter. So this is the slimming down at work. And so you see people being replaced by artificial intelligence, by robotics. And so, yeah, the McJob, as much as it's been maligned by some people, heralded by others, the McJob is becoming a something of an endangered species, Lee. Speaking of things that may or may not be endangered, Gavin Newsom, he is Lee next week traveling to the Vatican to take part in a climate summit. Very hard for me to resist the urge of comparing Newsom to Nero and fiddling while his state is burning by going to do this. But is this really what the governor should be doing in May, given that he has a messy budget he has to deal with, given that you still have campus unrest going on and other myriad issues? And by the way, when you look at climate change in California, Lee, let me throw some numbers at you. According to the California Green Innovation Index released in March, California is not even close to its goal of reducing greenhouse gases by 48% from 1990 levels by the end of this decade. Lee, the state's hard pressed to reduce its emissions by 4% a year. It's only happened twice, Lee, in 2009 and 2020. What do those years have in common? The economy was a shambles.
Bill, we've talked a number of times, and media, including very liberal media such as the San Francisco Chronicle, has talked about Gavin's forgotten that he has a day job. And so, yeah, off he goes to Rome, off he goes to the Vatican. There's potentially a $73 billion deficit within the state that needs to be dealt with. And Bill, the size of that deficit is bigger than the general fund of all but two states in the country. Only New York and Texas have larger general fund budgets than our deficit, just to give people a sense of the size of what we're dealing with here. And really, what's the level of irresponsibility? Under Newsom, spending per Californian has increased 57% since he took office in early 2019. I don't think there's any other state. I don't know. I didn't look at the New York numbers, but I doubt there's any other state that comes close to that. That's just fiscally irresponsible to grow spending by 10% per year, particularly in a state that's losing people, and particularly in a state where the money is being burned through, as we were just talking about, and people are just really aren't getting the value of the tax dollars that they're spending. So to me, it seems incredibly tone deaf that this is what he is doing. You would think just for PR purposes, he would be here dealing with what appear to be much more pressing issues than climate change. And no matter how you feel about climate change, it's carbon emissions are a global issue. California is less than 0.5% of global carbon emissions. No matter how you feel about what they do to the climate, it seems to be a non-starter. So, you just wonder, what's Gavin, I think he just can't help himself. He
No,
wants to
Governor.
be on the national stage, and this is what he loves to talk about. I guess John Kerry is going to be there as well.
Yeah, terrific. So the governor's feeling his oats these days, Lee. He recently climbed to the top of the Golden Gate Bridge to tout record tourist numbers in the Golden State. They passed $150 billion annually for the first time, and there he was perched atop the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was bragging about how the economy is still fifth in the world, population's on the rise, we are back, baby. Meanwhile, Lee, the California's Tourism Council has come out with a new slogan. The new name for the Golden State is, quote, "the ultimate playground."
Well, it might be the ultimate playground. For people who are coming here, get ready to pay an awful lot for a hotel, an awful lot for fast food, and be careful where you walk in Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego. Be careful the areas that you visit, and watch where you're walking. That's that's the uh, that's 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 the fine print that should come with the ultimate playground advertisement.
I don't know, the playground leaf seems like a pretty good metaphor to talk about sandboxes and bullies and slides and all the things you find in daycare that you also find in your state government. Final note, Lee, U.S. News and World Report is out with its best states rankings for 2024. California finished 37th overall. Lee, that's because it's in the mid-30s in most of the categories here, which included healthcare, natural environment, crime, corrections, infrastructure, fiscal instability. But one number stands out, Lee, when it came to opportunity, which U.S. News World Report defines as economic opportunity, affordability, and equality. Do you want to guess where California finished, Lee?
Bill, I'm guessing it's pretty close to the bottom.
Try bottom, 50th, dead last. So 50th in opportunity.
I hedged myself a little bit there.
Now, I would note, Lee, that Gavin Newsom's nemesis, Florida, was 45th in opportunity. But where did Florida do well? It finished first in economy and first in education.
Yeah, and Bill, they spend so much less per pupil on education. And among our kids, you know, our education budget this last year was nearly $130 billion. $130 billion. And three out of four of our kids lack proficiency in math, reading, and science. So again, spending a lot of money. A lot of state policymakers like to talk about how much they're spending, but it simply isn't showing up in terms of what we need to achieve. It's wasting a lot of taxpayer money. And Bill, you know, out of those three out of four kids that can't read or write or do math at grade level, they're living here in California. You know, welcome to some of the youngest future homeless people. I hate to say that, but I just don't see any conclusion beyond that.
Okay. So let me point you in the direction of economic opportunity, Lee, and affordability. If you were asked to address either one of those, what would you do?
People are leaving California, businesses are leaving California, and there's the simple reason, which is for people, cost of living is just simply way too high. California workers do earn a little bit of a premium compared to the rest of the country, but the reason it isn't bigger is because business costs are so high. So we California really needs a policy reset in terms of regulatory burdens on businesses and regulatory burdens on families, which includes the California Environmental Quality Act. Median home price in California now is about $850,000. Only 17% of California households can afford that home. So, you know, you look at a family of four, even if their income is in the six-figure range, they're not coming close to being able to afford a home, but they can move to many states, including Texas, including Florida, Tennessee, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, the Midwest. They can buy a beautiful home on a six-figure household income. Making changes to the regulations that create so much expenses for households and create so much expenses for businesses. You get down household costs, you get down business costs, and then you enjoy the synergies of businesses want to hire more. And so compensation goes up and households can afford to live here and their salaries are going up. So it's like, okay, what's not to like about that? But there just seems to be a level of deafness within the state capitol about making these changes because, Bill, it's a supermajority state. They should be able to get done anything they want to get done and have Newsom sign it. But year after year, we keep seeing people complaining about California Environmental Quality Act, the cost of living, bad schools, the lack of water, the cost of doing business here. Nothing gets done. So we've lost 500,000 people since 2019. And we've lost, it's a little bit hard to count lost businesses because most of them just go under the radar. But we've talked about business losses many times. Of the businesses that we know that leave that are sufficiently large to have to report their plans to exit to the state, those business losses have more than doubled in recent years. So until policies change, we're going to keep seeing the same thing.
So one idea, Lee, would be to have a constitutional convention, which we've not done since the latter part of the 19th century here in California, and kind of blow everything up and start over again. But you know what? Given that our governor is going to the Vatican, Lee, I think we consider that a Hail Mary.
Yeah, that's a Hail Mary. It's good to know. It's good to know that the Vatican is on top of the priority list over all the other things that need to get done here.
Okay, Lee, we're going to leave it there. I hope the rest of the school year goes swimmingly for you, despite what's going on that campus.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks, Bill. Good to chat.
You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our show. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends in the loop. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and X feeds. Our X handle is @HooverInst. That's spelled HOOVERINST. Leo Hanian is on X, brave man that he is. His X handle is @Lee_Ohanian. Ohanian spelled OHANIAN. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BillWhalenCA. That's BillWhalenCA. I mentioned our website at the beginning of the broadcast. That's hoover.org. While you're there, you should sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the latest in all things Hoover to you, news, commentary, research that goes to your inbox weekdays. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution, where we generate and promote ideas advancing freedom. For more information about our work, to hear more of our podcasts, or view our video content, please visit hoover.org.